Welcome to New Books in Language. My guest today is Anne Cutler, and we're talking about her book, Native Listening, in which she provides a fascinating overview of much recent work on speech perception, and argues the case that, in some sense, languages train their native speakers, or native listeners, to process them in a particular way. In this interview, we discuss some of the critical findings, and also talk about how we can use language-specific results to inform our understanding of the human language faculty in general. And I learn, among other things, why we need child language labs in Morocco, and what kind of language experience is available in utero for humans, and indeed for sheep. I'm delighted to welcome Anne Cutler to talk about her book, Native Listening, in which she discusses the many aspects of processing that go into our understanding of language as hearers and what they tell us about cognition. Anne, this book draws upon a wealth of research, much of which is your own, along with colleagues. How did it come together?
Well, you know, why do you write a book? There are always multiple reasons. I mean, first of all, there is no other book like it. There's no other book on spoken word recognition. It's a small field, you know. It's a relatively new field, but it's extremely active. It's been extremely active in recent years, and there's a huge amount of work. But there had been no book on it. And also, most people who do spoken word recognition in the laboratory come from originally from psychology, and they're fascinated and interested in language, but they don't necessarily have a linguistic background. And so the main message of the book, that the way we listen to speech is at every point determined in some way by the native language we grew up with. That's a message I really wanted to get across to the whole spoken word recognition and wider psycholinguistic community. So I wanted people to be able to see the influence of the native language in the actual process of listening to speech, which we do every day. And as I said, there was no book, and it was kind of I was about to retire. And it seemed like a very good time to sum up what I've been doing for the last few decades and put it all together, because I had a very coherent picture by that time.
Yeah, and I think that coherence is very much reflected in the book. As you say, you make the point very emphatically throughout the book and right from the beginning that the native language is essential, and for that reason that cross-linguistic study of language is essential. Because although the human capabilities may not differ, speakers of different languages certainly differ in the abilities they actually make use of. Is this something you feel is often underappreciated?
Oh, absolutely. Now, again, let me give you a couple of examples. For instance, in all of the speech perception textbooks, you'll read that transitional cues from a vowel into a consonant are very important for the perception of F, you know, but not so important for the perception of S sounds, because the traditional account is that S sounds are more strident and have more clear, salient acoustic information, and so you don't need to listen to the subtle cues in the vowel preceding them. And F is a weaker sound, and you do need to listen to the subtle cues. But then along came my student Anita Wagner, and she happens to be a native speaker of both German and Polish. But in particular, for Polish, she thought this is really not going to work. I have to tell you that if you have a gut feeling about what does and doesn't work, that's the best way to start off a scientific career. Anyway, she tested this and found that all the experiments had been done in English before, and she got the same result for English. But when she tried it in Dutch and German, she didn't get that result, because in Dutch and German and Italian, nobody was paying attention to the cues in the vowel for either S or F. But then she got the same English result when she tested in Spanish. So she was doing all this cross-linguistic research, and she was finding, okay, you get the textbook result for English and you get it for Spanish, but you don't get it for Dutch, German, or Italian. So what do English and Spanish have? This was Castilian Spanish, incidentally. What do they have that those other three languages don't have? Well, the sound for the theta, you know, as in thin versus fin, right? And th is so like f. You can see that in any perceptual confusion study that you do, that it's the necessity in your language for having to distinguish the sound f from a very similar sound that leads to that result. And you don't have to distinguish s from any similar sound in any of those languages, English, Spanish, Dutch, German, or Italian. But of course you do in Polish, and so when she did the experiments in Polish, which has several dental fricatives like s, she found exactly the opposite result. So the point is that she tested across altogether six different languages. And in those six languages, the cues in the signal, the acoustic information in the signal is basically the same. You know, if you grew up speaking Spanish or Polish, the shape of your mouth is going to be exactly the same, you know, similar for all of these languages. It's, your mouth, the shape of your mouth doesn't determine what language you speak. And so the, cues that you make in a vowel before your mouth moves to making a s or a s are going to be exactly the same across all of these languages. They're all there in the signal. But the point is, it's your language that determines whether it's important for you to use those cues, right? And there are loads of examples of this just all the way through the book, not just at the phoneme level, but for instance, the recurring story throughout the book of lexical stress. So in lexical stress languages, you know, there are very clear cues in the signal which distinguish stressed syllables from unstressed syllables and different levels of stress, so primary versus secondary stress. You know, it's all there in the signal, but it so happens that for English, the distribution of vowels across stressed versus unstressed syllables is such that unstressed syllables tend very much to be reduced. So for English listeners, it's important to pay attention to stress in the sense that we distinguish a full vowel from a reduced vowel, but we don't really have to go into the gradations of stress for English. But in other languages, you do. So compare Dutch with English, for instance. So Dutch is a very closely related language to English. They're very similar. Loads and loads of cognate pairs. Now, you take a word like cigar in English. Now, the first syllable is going to be reduced. It's cigar, right? And you have exactly the same word in Dutch, but it's sigaar, right? So the first syllable is not reduced. It's secondary stress. And you can take cobra, you know, cobra, the snake. So that's the second syllable in English is reduced. It's just a schwa. And exactly the same word occurs in Dutch, except you pronounce it cobra, you know, and the first syllable has primary stress and the second syllable has secondary stress and the four vowels, it's not schwa. And so all of those cognates in Dutch are not reduced to the same extent that they are in English, which means that, of course, this pattern goes throughout the Dutch vocabulary. You have loads and loads of syllables that are unstressed but still have reduced vowels, and that don't have reduced vowels, still have full vowels. And so for Dutch listeners growing up speaking their language, they have to learn to pay attention to gradations of stress in order to recognize words quickly in a way that English listeners simply don't have to do. This has both a good side and a bad side for both listener groups, obviously. So a nice little win for Dutch listeners to English is so that they can actually perceive levels of stress in English better than English native listeners can. That's all described in great detail in the book. And that should help them, you know, a little bit in understanding spoken English. English listeners don't need to do that. If you put them in an experiment where they have to listen to stress in order to make a decision about a syllable that's been excised from its context, they're actually extraordinarily bad at doing it. You know, but that's because they really don't have to learn this. And in work that isn't in the book, we've just been running an enormous speech perception experiment with identifying all the phonemes of English from fragments, and we already did that for Dutch. And what we find is that there's a stress effect in the English data that is actually much larger than in the Dutch data, and that's because as soon as a vowel is unstressed in English, the English listener is expected to be reduced, and they don't really pay attention to the vowel quality. They're actually quite bad at identifying unstressed vowels in English in a way that the Dutch never were in the parallel Dutch experiment. So again, you see, no matter how you look at it, that there are good sides and bad sides to all of these differences. But just about every level of the spoken word recognition process, you can find some effect that is acoustically universal across all the languages that have stress or have S and F, for instance. The effect in the acoustics is the same, but the use you make of it is.
So the story would be that if we were to study just one language, for example, English, we would be able to identify certain universal properties, but we would miss out completely on others. I guess that means it's going to be quite hard to come up with a full inventory of all the capabilities that might be used in certain languages. How close do you feel we can get to that?
Well, I think that phonologists have been doing a lot of the basic work that we need. We know what the interesting possible patterns are across languages. We don't have to go and test every experiment in every language in the world, you know, because you can imagine that if a language has, for instance, lexical stress, then you look at how it works in that language, and you should be able to predict what aspects of it will be used in spoken word recognition by listeners. And if a language has particular phoneme inventories, it's going to be exactly the same. You can predict that any language with S and F will show the same pattern as English and Spanish, for instance, and any language like Polish will show the same pattern. You don't have to go and do the experiments in all of those, though I'm sure that there are quite a lot of nice undergraduate projects that could result if you did. And so it goes on with the populations of possible phonological structures are, I think, not a mystery to us anymore. I think the phonologists have been extremely well occupied over many centuries to let us know what possibilities we're dealing with. Maybe there are some surprises we've had with, for instance, the double articulations in some of the Pacific Rim languages. But nevertheless, I think that it's not going to be the case that there are huge phonological differences out there that are going to change the picture.
But you suggest at various points that maybe in the area of prosody, the landscape isn't quite so well understood. Would that be fair?
I think that's true. Yes, I think it's an enormous growth area, and I think this is definitely going to change. But there's so much work to be done especially in the subtle interplay of prosodic structures across languages and the possibilities of misuse of your native language prosodic expectations in listening to a second language, for instance. There's been very little work on that. I think stress has attracted quite. Both lexical stress and sentence stress, I think, have had a fair number of experiments done across languages. But sentence prosody and other prosodic systems, such as pitch accents and so on, they're well understood in native processing. But there's still an awful lot of work to do in second language processing.
Sure. To return to the linear order of the book. In chapter 2, you discuss the nature of spoken language, and in particular the theoretical difficulty, at least, of identifying words in the speech stream, given the prevalence of so many embedded words there. This is something we're really not normally aware of in native listening, are we?
No, humans aren't. I can tell you where people do become aware of it, and that's when they try and speak to a computer. Because you can talk to a computer and only in those systems that are completely constrained, where you're only allowed to say words from a certain vocabulary, you know. But if you try and talk to your mobile phone, or you start to use a dictation system or something, and then you see what it comes up with, especially while you're training it first. You'll very quickly see that it comes up with words that were actually well supported by the signal, but you had no idea that they were there. You know, so actually playing with a new dictation system will quickly give you an insight into that. And it doesn't matter what language you're speaking, because every language has exactly the same problem which causes this, namely a relatively small phoneme set of only a few dozen phonemes, speech sounds, and a huge vocabulary of words that you build out of them. You know, so it's inevitable that words are very, very like one another, and any long word is extremely likely to have shorter words embedded within it. And in fact, the fewer phonemes your language has, the longer your words tend to be, and the more embedding you tend to have. So even if you have a lot of phonemes, like your native language, British English, is really wildly profligate in having over 40 phonemes. You know, that's an awful lot, because the average, or the modal number, the most common recurring number of phonemes across languages is 25, Chris. So 46 or whatever British English has. That's really, really been quite profligate. But nevertheless, of course, 46 is also not enough to do anything practical about the embedding problem. It's going to happen everywhere. That's another thing we've been looking at since the book came out, and this is also not in the book, but something that's in all the literature is again that there tend to be more words embedded at the beginnings of longer words than at the ends, and that's important because it has implications for exactly what competitors you're comparing and rejecting at any particular point while you're listening to speech, and so there's been a lot of work done on this very fact that you you spend more time getting rid of competitors for the beginnings of words than for the ends of words. But it turns out that that's not true across languages either. In Japanese, for instance, it's almost exactly the same in word initial and word final position. So it turns out that it's merely an artifact of two things tend to skew where words are embedded. So if you have a lot of suffixes, then the ends of words are unlikely to be standalone words by themselves. The last syllable, for instance, is going to be a suffix. Well, Japanese doesn't have suffixes, so that's one big explanation. But also stress has a separate contribution, and especially in a language where you have a lot of vowel reduction, like English, and German even more so. And each of those two factors separately contributes, so that the asymmetry between the beginnings and ends of words as to where shorter words are embedded in longer ones is much greater in the Germanic languages than in French, which does not have stress but does have suffixes, and greater in French again than in Japanese, which has neither. So again, you see that the tasks, the listener's task, is subtly affected by the morphological and prosodic patterns of the native language, so that the kinds of competition that you're getting rid of when listening to Japanese speech is slightly differently arranged from the competition patterns in European languages.
You discuss in the following chapter how we can go about modeling this competition, and in particular you give a sort of historical overview of computational models of word activation, historically on through to the Bayesian shortlist B model of Norris and McQueen. It seems that you're very keen to emphasize the usefulness of this cycle of experimentation and simulation.
Yes, absolutely. It's something we're still doing. I think I may even have forecast in the book that a shortlist B version for English, which will be available for everybody to do Bayesian simulations of their spoken word recognition experiments in English, will be coming soon. And I already referred to the large speech experiment we were doing, where we got an unexpectedly large stress effect for English, that English people are very bad at recognizing stress, unstressed but full vowels. Shouldn't have been a surprise to us, but the effect was quite substantial. And that experiment has just been completed, and that is becoming the new front end to an English version of shortlist B. So yes, this is still going on, and it's extremely important to us because it just gets your research and your theorizing moving together in progressing at the in concert, you know. So that, for instance, I also describe in, I guess, chapter 5 of the book, the possible word constraint, where this turns out to be a major effect in listening to speech, where you have all these words being activated that are there in the speech signal just briefly, and you have to find the right ones that the speaker actually said and get and discard all these spurious competitors that are embedded words or overlapping words or partially supported words. And one of the things you do is that if a word is activated that is embedded in another word, but it leaves something over that couldn't possibly be a word because it only consists of a consonant. For instance, if you hear the word bring, then ring will be activated, but it would leave b without anything to do. So you can immediately get rid of it on that basis. Now, you might think that is pretty obvious, but it turns out to be a very, very powerful and rapid effect in listening to speech. Well, the way we discovered it was actually by running simulations with the shortlist model, because we'd been running some experiments in British English, where we found that a word, we'll be using the word spotting task, and you listen to a nonsense word, and you have to find the word that's embedded in it, and mostly that's pretty easy. So, for instance, one of the examples that we used was jump in and we would give people jump move, and they had to find that there was jump in it, and that's quite hard because English listeners are very prone to segment speech at the onset of stressed syllables. Any full syllable, which is likely to be a word onset in English. And so jump move is harder to find jump in than jump of. Now, jump of was very easy, and that's what we predicted. But in British English, jump of actually has two words embedded in it. And that's a no-no for a word spotting task. You should only have one word that the subject in your experiment can possibly find. And in fact, nobody ever found anything, and probably no listener at the moment is finding anything except jump and jump of. And but in fact, the word jumper, which this is British English, right? So there's no er at the end of that. It's jumper. It's an item of clothing, and jumper is a very common word, and it's in jump of. But none of us who are running the experiment had ever noticed that, and none of the subjects ever in this experiment came up with jumper. So what was going on? Because it's there and the model immediately found it, right? But the point is that if you've got jumper in jumper, then the only thing that's left over is the, and that fails the possible word constraint. So immediately jumper is ruled out, and you can find jump, right? And when we realized that the model was actually doing something very, very sensible, we started to think, well, hey, this is quite a powerful constraint, so let's test it in experiments. But we didn't think of the experiments until the model had given us that idea. So, and then the model, of course, had to be given the possible word constraint so that it would behave like listeners, and then it behaved even more accurately as a result. So it's a kind of an interplay between modeling what you've got and seeing that if you have that model, then what predictions does it make next, testing them and finding out the results of experiments which will then improve the model, and then the model can make even better predictions, and so it goes on. So yes, it surely helps you get much faster ahead in modeling your chosen area of psychology.
And the possible word constraint is another one of these observations that does modulate slightly across different languages, as you discussed.
Oh, yes, that was such a saga. Yes, we spent nearly 20 years working on this because. I won't do the whole chapter on it in the book because of all the different languages that we have to test various things in because you know, you can say, okay, couldn't be a syllable, but it couldn't be a word of the language, or couldn't be a word of the language. But of course, there are some words in that are just a single syllable, or you can reduce words to a single sound that is actually consonantal, for instance. But that doesn't stop the operation of the possible. Those word reduction phenomena don't stop the operation of the possible word constraint, and nor it seems to do the kind of reduction of surface syllables where there's an underlying vowel is in Japanese vowel devoicing or some of the Portuguese consonantal sequences where there's an underlying vowel that's written but it doesn't surface in what you say. But still, in all these languages, we found that the possible word constraint was just exactly the same. But the really crucial test case was a language which would allow any standalone open class word, noun, verb, adjective, anything, to have no vowel in it, have consonantal syllabic nuclei. And there are a few such languages in the world. Phonologists, again, have been wonderful in falling with great glee on these languages and writing an awful lot about them. So we know about the languages of the Northwest Pacific Coast in like Spokane and Bella Coola. They have that property. There are some languages in Georgia and in the Balkan states that have that property. But the main and best documented language family with standalone words that consist only of consonants in Berber, the Berber family of languages. And so we actually did these word spotting experiments in both Tashalit and Tarifit Berber. And in there, the only languages in all of the dozens of languages that the possible word constraint has been tested in, both these Berber dialects, no trace of it, no trace of it. So what we don't know, of course, is whether infant Berber speakers actually develop a possible word constraint and then have to lose it when they realize that their vocabulary doesn't encourage it, because there are arguments for that, or whether they never develop it in the first place. Now, the arguments for developing the possible word constraint are that we think it's probably extremely primitive and easy for infants to develop. Infants do show it, by the way, but we've only tested the English acquiring infants. It's very easy to see that speech consists of a class of sounds that are vocalic and a class of sounds that are consonantal, and that they differ in how they're distributed across speech, and that's something that an infant can tune into very very quickly. And there is also evidence that in Berber, baby talk to Berber infants has more vowels in it than the adult language has. So we don't know the answer to this. So let's hope that some days there'll be a baby lab somewhere in one of the universities in Morocco, and somebody will test this out. But as of yet, we don't know the answer to that. But we do know that adult Berber speakers do not show the possible word constraint, because it wouldn't help them. It would hinder listening to Berber if you applied it. So of course they don't. So again, that's just exactly what you would predict by the fact that you do what your language requires you to do when listening to speech.
Indeed, yes. Turning back to the models briefly, we discussed in passing the shortlist and shortlist B models of word activation. The impression I have is that you consider these particularly apposite in various ways. Is there something in particular that distinguishes these, that makes them particularly attractive or promising?
Well, the useful thing for us using shortlist is that it runs on a real dictionary, so that you can simulate your experimental results in that model with something like the real vocabulary that your participants in your experiments have brought into the lab with them. Most of the earlier models were either not computational or had much, much smaller dictionaries, so that you would have to run an experiment on just a small set of words, or specifically add a word to the dictionary, but then you wouldn't know what competitors to add to it. It enables us to just quickly run a simulation of our experimental results and just assume that all the words that are playing a role are there in the dictionary, and that's a very, very handy computational feature. That's the main reason why we use that model. Of course, my student, my very first graduate student and long, long time dear colleague, Dennis Norris, created the model, but he deliberately created it to have this property, and that makes it extremely useful.
Yep. Much later in the book, you discuss the question of bottom-up versus top-down or bidirectional models. You state a preference, but you also opine very even-handedly that the question really can't be settled yet for all sorts of reasons. Do you think it will be? And if so, how do you think it will be?
That is a good question. I think that there are ways in which every point, every position in this debate has a positive side to it, right? So I and my colleagues have tried to argue the traditional Occam's razor approach that you don't add elements to your model unless you're absolutely forced to, because the more complicated the model gets, the more unexpected properties it can turn out to have as a result. If you have top-down flow of information, then what it does is it constrains the possibilities at an earlier processing level. So that means that some things that you might have done become impossible, right? Now, that is what we want to avoid, because you can, for instance, with top-down flow of information, then induce hallucinations. You know, your expectation can be so strong. So if I say a stitch in time saves, and then I might want to say me, and the idea would be that if you have strong top-down flow of information, the only thing you can hear at that point is the word nine, a stitch in time saves nine, right? And so you would hear me as nine. Well, of course, you don't want to do that, do you? So you do not want to allow strong top-down flow of information actually ruling out possibilities at an earlier level. So now that's an exaggerated case, but that's what you want to avoid. And you can explain how odd a stitch in time saves me sounds by allowing the same effect to happen at a later level, when you're integrating the word me into this context, and you say, that sounds really odd, not what I was expecting. So, but you did successfully perceive it, and that's what we always do in the case of puns. You laugh because it wasn't what you were expecting. Somebody said something quite clever and related to what you were expecting, but not exactly what you're expecting. But you notice it immediately, and you notice it because you didn't overrule the lower level processing from your expectations. Nevertheless, the experiments that have been done to understand exactly how context effects work are getting more and more elaborate and intricate. Especially brain imaging experiments now are particularly interested in this topic, and I think we will, just like we've always had philosophical positions on different topics that have gone on lasting forever, we will probably be able to debate this issue for quite a long time to come.
In chapter 8, you cover the emergence of language specificity in development, and there's some really fascinating work here, as well as probably
easily.
And a completely, I think, unique subsection title to 8.1, What Fetal Sheep Might Extract from the Input.
Yes.
Because you discuss the familiar observation that children lose the ability to detect certain contrasts as they mature, but there's a lot more going on here, isn't there?
There is, and some of it happened before birth, and that was the rationale for the fetal sheep project, because it turns out that if you're looking for another organism that has a similar gestation time and a similar fetal growth period and that is cycle and and a similar amount of bodily material between the auditory apparatus of the fetus in the womb and the outside world, then the sheep is about as close as you can get to the human. And this group in Florida did a whole lot of nice work recording in placing little microphones inside the womb of sheep and recording what could be heard from people talking and so on in the outside world. And it's actually a remarkably large amount. And we know that the infant's brain and auditory apparatus is pretty well developed in the last trimester of the mother's pregnancy, and so for those last 3 months, the infant is actually hearing a lot in the womb. Of course, mothers know that because they know that that infants respond differently in the womb to different outside sounds like vacuum cleaners and versus pianos and so on. And in fact, all the experiments show that when an infant is born at birth, that is within the first hours of birth, you can show that they recognize the mother's voice and they recognize the maternal language, and they distinguish it from very, very similar languages. So they would, for instance, get Dutch and English hopelessly mixed up, but they certainly know that if they're learning Dutch or English, that it is not Japanese and it's not Italian. They have completely different kinds of patterns, and they certainly prefer to listen to the maternal language pattern. So all of that is happening in the womb, which is why the experiments on sheep have actually taught us something about what the infant can hear.
Indeed, yeah. You construe this in terms of languages training their speakers, or rather their listeners. And in the concluding chapters of the book, you discuss some of the implications of that for second language learning. It's my impression that you wouldn't really endorse the idea of a critical period per se, but you'd rather explain a sort of gradient effect of losing the ability to acquire language in terms of these well-motivated specializations to the native language. Is that fair?
Yes, that's exactly right. What's quite interesting is the convergence across different areas of linguistics in this notion, actually, because I was recently at a symposium in honor of Bill Lebov, who just the great social linguist who got the Franklin Medal for Science this year, only the second linguist after Chomsky to receive this great medal. And at that symposium, there was some discussion of what's the tipping point for a phonological merger in language change. So Bill Lebov has done a lot of work on mergers across vowel categories, for instance. So what happens that actually tips it so that a variety moves from one set of categories to another? And it seems to be infants being born and only being exposed to the merged variety. That as long as there are people around who had the set of categories pre-merger, then you haven't got a full change. Now that means that you've got here a dialectal and language change phenomenon, which is addressing the same issues as I'm talking about in terms of different languages and acquiring a second language. So what it basically means is that once you've got a set of categories as an infant, it's quite difficult to, for instance, expand that set of categories. And that's the hardest thing to do in phonetic perception, for instance. If your native language doesn't have the distinction between r and l, right and light, then you know it's really hard to acquire that perceptual distinction. So it seems that we can adjust the boundaries between categories to change vowels, for instance, slightly across our lifetime without noticing it. We can adjust to speakers without noticing it, because that's just adjusting exactly how you interpret a particular set of categories. But changing the set of categories is a real tipping point. And that's true in second language, and it's true in language change.
I'd like to conclude, if I may, by asking about your own research plans. You mentioned, on the one hand, retirement, but from all you've said about the many strands of work that you're continuing to pursue with colleagues, that seems to be rather a technical use of that term.
No, I'm actually working at my other job. The European universities and research institutions have European retirement ages. You know, you just have to retire at a certain age and you don't get your salary after that age in Europe. But that's not true in America, and it's not true in Australia either. And so many years ago, I started setting up a lab in Sydney and gradually moving. So I was working part-time in Sydney and part-time in Nijmegen for the last 6 years that I was in Nijmegen. And when my retirement age actually came to pass in January this year, I formally retired from the Max Planck Institute, and I'm now only in my other job. But my other job is just a research professorship in Sydney, and I just keep on doing what I'm doing.
What do you see as the particularly promising avenues of research in general in this field? I mean, there are so many, and we talked about several, but
Yes, there are many, and I must say that one of the most interesting aspects of writing the book is how it focuses you on how I'm sure it's the case for everybody who writes such a book. It focuses one on the unanswered questions. So I have a fuller research agenda now than I could have imagined a few years ago. I'm particularly interested in tracking down the various forms of native language advantage. You know, so why is it, for instance, that when you speak a second language very well, and you're absolutely just fine in your second language one-on-one, and then you go down to the pub or the cafe or the bar with your mates, and there's a whole lot of background noise and music and lots of people talking at once, and suddenly your one-on-one fluency in listening, your ability to understand everything, absolutely everything, has just completely disappeared, you know, and the compensation that you can do in your native language, you don't seem to master in your second language. And people report that even after like 20, 30 years in speaking a second language. So what is the actual underlying mechanism that gives the native language an advantage in listening in noise in that kind of situation? What is the mechanism also that gives the native language an advantage in recognizing and identifying talkers, so that when you, for instance, are listening to an unfamiliar talker, have you heard them before or not? It's much easier to make that decision in your native language, and forensic scientists know that very well. That if people don't speak a language very well, they're not very good at identifying whether a particular talker is somebody they heard, for instance, plotting a robbery or whatever. So voice recognition, what is the advantage, what is the actual source of the native language advantage in voice recognition? We know it's not actually being able to understand what's going on, because infants can do it. So we discovered that 7 months, you know, infants at 7 months don't understand anything, but they can tell when you've added a new speaker to a set of, so you have a set of three speakers saying things, you add a fourth speaker, they'll notice it immediately. If they're speaking the native language, but if they're speaking some other language, they won't even notice. So What is the underlying, presumably phonological processing that's advantaging the native language in that case? And what about spotting dialects, for instance? You know, people can spot dialects and say, oh, you know, you're from Yorkshire, or in America, you're from Alabama. But it's not so good in another variety of your own native language, and it's pretty hopeless in your second language. You know, after 20 years in the Netherlands, I still couldn't immediately say you're from The Hague or you're from Groningen. I couldn't do that. So what is the actual mechanism underlying the native language advantage in distinguishing between varieties? So all of these ways in which the native language has an advantage, I would like to, these are not fully understood now, and that's what I would like to understand in the next few years.
It does sound like an extraordinary challenge, and I wish you every success with it. For the moment, let me just say, Anne Cutler, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome, Chris.
I've been talking to Anne Cutler about her book, Native Listening. This is Chris Cummins for New Books in Language, saying thank you for listening.